Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah Beth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
It's funny to hear someone call me a lady speaker, because I still feel about 20 or 15. And also, I don't think anybody would have said that before. So, anyway, it kind of cracks me up. So I think I've been up here two times before. And I love coming here. I love this group, and I don't get up here much, and every time I come because someone's asked me to come, I always wish I came more. So I'm still wishing that today. I'm really grateful to be speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I use my moment of silence to think about all the other Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that must be going on at this very moment. And it blows my mind because that's just the 6 o'clock hour. And I figure there are drunks all over the world sitting down, getting ready to listen to somebody or getting ready to talk about something. And it blows my mind, really. So then when we close and we're saying whatever prayer we happen to say in the group we're in, I think about the same thing and how many drunks are gathered at this very moment in an AA meeting, wherever. So I just wanted to mention that because I go into so many meetings that it's a way of life. And I like to take a few minutes to think about the miracle that is every day as a sober member of AA, even if I'm kind of hating it. Whatever's going on at the moment, you know, the drama du jour, there's a lot less than it used to be in my life, but I have sort of affectionately referred to myself as a bit of a malcontent, and I'm a generally happy person, but there are things that happen throughout the day that I just kind of get kind of grumpy about, or I wish they were different, or it kind of bums me out, or something's disappointing, and it's a little hard for me to imagine where I would be if I didn't have this program in my life to, like, sweep me along through those moments. I mean, something bad can... I was just thinking, when I chose to say the phrase, when I'm hating it, I was thinking, before I might have said, when I'm hating the day, hating the whole day. I just don't have that anymore, where I'm hating the whole day. I might be frustrated with what's going on for a few minutes or some circumstances in my life. But usually what I'm mostly frustrated about is how I'm sitting there obsessing about them or worrying about them, and I don't have to. So I get frustrated with myself. And if you've been around a while, you probably understand exactly what I'm talking about. And if you're new, you might be thinking, yeah, I'm still having hateful days. But Alcoholics Anonymous has really helped me shift my attitude. And the funny thing is, I did not really believe or know that it needed shifting. So that's kind of enlightening. Anyhow, sometimes when I speak, I want to say. Well, sorry about my incredibly flat affect and my monotone voice. And usually what happens is when I get going, then I get going. But it might not happen, so I'll apologize. I love talking at an AA meeting. And it's not like I love being up here, like I got to be speaking or I'm not happy. This is an honor to be asked to come up here and talk. But I just like sitting around sober AA members. Actually, I don't care if you're sober or not. I like sitting around AA members, even the ones who are struggling, and just being people who are trying to be sober, who are trying to walk this way of life. And my life is so rich now that I don't have enough hours in the day, and these are still my favorite moments. They're just always, to me, the most beautiful moments. But if I started saying something else, I forgot. I'll tell you that I got sober March 29th, 1987. And I was 22 years old. So I'm 51 now. And if you would have told me that I was an alcoholic, I would have died laughing or gotten mad and punched you in the eye. I didn't know it. And sometimes when I talk about my story, I talk for kind of way too long about how I didn't know it. All the different ways I was in denial and there were so many clues that I missed. And that's really interesting to me when I think about it, because when I finally had the moment of clarity that I was able to pay attention to, I went from believing I had nothing in common with alcoholics and the members of AA to everything that matters. And there wasn't a whole lot of middle ground. It was like I thought I didn't belong here at all. I didn't follow any suggestions. I just hung around AA, didn't work any steps. You know the deal. Out I went. I stayed out for a year and a half. I always think it's kind of funny the way the big book says, if you're not convinced, step into the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking because it might be worth a good case of the jitters. I'm like, it's interesting to me that they decided to understate that so much. Might be worth a good case of the jitters, because after I had a head full of AA and a belly full of beer, the year and a half that I was out was no case of the jitters. It was absolutely horrible. And it was, I think it was horrible because I think alcoholism progresses. But I think one of the reasons it was horrible is, you know, we say sometimes jokingly around here, AA ruined your drinking. I knew the whole entire time that it didn't have to be this way. But in the beginning, I didn't care. And in the end, I couldn't help it. And those were some painful but crucial times, and I'm really grateful that I survived them. So when I get up and talk, I go into the bathroom and I get on my knees and I say, God, help me say my name and say the truth. And whatever the message is, help me be a channel of it, or get me out of the way, or whatever the deal is. I don't have any kind of canned talk. No offense to the can talkers or anything, the note readers. No offense to them, because they have to do whatever they have to do to carry their message. The way that I try to carry the message is to get up here and just ask for some guidance and start talking, and whatever comes out. And sometimes that works out really well, and sometimes it doesn't. And the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it isn't about that. And I could almost stand up here and just say blah, blah, blah for an hour if anyone could take it. And what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous would happen here anyway, if that makes sense. I'm just thinking about how I've had the opportunity to go to other countries and sit in some meetings in some other languages, and all I had to do was walk in the door to know that I was in an AA meeting. And there was something about the feel of what was going on in there, even though I didn't understand. So that particular feeling got on me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't think I was an alcoholic. The feeling of what was happening in an AA meeting made a serious impression on me. And while I was one of those people that walked around and said, hey, it's really great that AA is here for you people, and this is really nice, and isn't this special, and I didn't think it had anything to do with me, I was really happy for you, because I could really feel some amazing stuff going on in here. And really, I had no clue what was going on in here. I just knew that it was fantastic. I also didn't know that I didn't have a clue. So I think the way that I was taught to speak at a meeting was to say a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I try to remember to thank the person who asked me. So thank you, Billy, for asking me to come talk. I appreciate it so much. And I also like to try to remember to talk about the steps, which seems absurd that I would talk about my sobriety without talking about the steps, but I don't always talk about them directly and how I went through them. And I don't tell a chronological story because I can't remember squat. And and it's not because I was a blackout drinker. It's because my brain doesn't work that way. And when I think about my story, what I think about mostly are my feelings and my fears. And the details of all the little situations I was in are getting kind of fuzzy. And there are a couple of stories that stick out in my mind that I try to talk about in an AA meeting, but they don't always come to my mind when I'm talking. And they are things about when my drinking was really bad and I drank anyway, or when I had moments of clarity and ignored them, or when I really wanted to get sober and couldn't. Because in the beginning, it wasn't like that. I stopped drinking on my own, and so when I came into AA, I thought, I'm not powerless over alcohol. Because if you can stop on your own, you're not powerless. That was my thinking. So here I am. And so I grew up in a family that I lovingly refer to as Leave It to Beaverish. I don't know if that would be offensive to them if they heard it, but and I can't say that I watched every single episode of Leave It to Beaver, but I felt like my parents were as perfect as parents can get. And that means they weren't perfect, because people are not perfect. But they were so loving and so supportive in so many ways, and nobody in my family drank, and I didn't have to come home to, like, what the hell was going to be going on in my house. And I met a lot of people in AA who had that going on, and that was one of the things that I thought made me different. But alcoholism doesn't care, but I didn't know it. So I'm growing up in my family with my two parents and my two brothers, one ahead of me and one behind me, and I was the only girl. And my older brother was like 8 years older than I was. I don't know what kind of trouble he was getting into, but it seemed like he wasn't getting caught very often, he was enough older than I was that I wasn't privy to the details. And then my younger brother seemed to get caught doing everything that he did. He was a year behind me. So at the time, I just thought, he's an idiot. It never occurred to me that he had any kind of problem or that there was any kind of substance abuse problem. I just thought, this guy's like a year younger than me. How come he gets caught doing everything? But what happened was the focus wasn't on me as a result. And I guess I was pretty smart. I picked up pretty quickly that, like, if I was smart about whatever it is that I was going to do, I probably wasn't going to get caught. And that doesn't mean that I spent my whole childhood lying to my parents about all sorts of things. But once I realized I wanted to drink, I started lying about it immediately. For a lot of different reasons. And one of the reasons was that what I felt inside my body when I wanted to drink was, here's me, here's the drink somewhere away from me, and whatever is in between is going to get plowed over. So it was in everyone's best interest for things to not be in between. So I figured the less people knew, the better. And I very quickly started concealing a lot of thoughts and feelings that I was having and concealing a lot of my behaviors. And by concealing my thoughts and behaviors, I thought, these are not outright lies. And it's just that it's a means to an end. I want to get from point A to point B. And if I provide people, my parents namely, with too many details, there's going to be interference. So I started concealing a lot of things. But what another interesting thing that happened, or interesting to me now that I think about it, is when I was young and I focused a lot on alcohol, if I focused on it too much, my friends would give me a look that made me really uncomfortable. Like, lots of my high school friends were drinking and trying to drink and everything when we could get alcohol. But when I proposed things like, let's go stand out in the back of the liquor store by the dumpster and see if we can wait for somebody who will go in there and get us some booze, I got some looks. like they weren't into that. They weren't into doing whatever they could to get alcohol. And when they said they wanted to get some beers together and go watch movies or go sit in the graveyard, that's what we did all the time, go sit in the graveyard or go sit by the train tracks, and I started talking about how much alcohol I wanted to get, I'd get the look again. And I just thought, this will not do. And I started keeping all that stuff to myself. So it started all kinds of behaviors, like I've said before when I've been talking, someone said, how many people are going? 8 people were going, I'd say 15. So whoever made the alcohol run, you know, would like get enough alcohol for more people. And then it would like amazingly all get used up. And probably in the spirit of 1 for you, 3 for me, you know, and I would just do things like open beers and pour them in my soda cups. And I think that in a social situation, this is not normal. But I really didn't want people to know. And so I don't know if that is shame or, like I said earlier, you know, a means to an end. If I start going into all this and someone's going to give me a bunch of lip or ask a lot of questions, so forget that. Let's just get right to it. And that's what I started doing. And I think a lot of my life I've been the kind of drinker that likes to sit on the couch and move as little as possible and drink as much as possible. And that kind of behavior somehow wound me up in the middle of some wild people. So I would be sitting on the couch drinking my drinks, sneaking it however I was going to sneak it, and my friends would be doing a bunch of crazy things. And it made it, by crazy I just mean like, you know, people would start drinking and I'd be thinking, well, it's going to be about an hour and a half before we have the first couple argument, and it's going to be about 2 hours before somebody pukes on the couch or, you know, somebody goes out in the woods and gets lost or comes home with half their clothes. There was just all this kind of stuff going on. It made it really easy for me to just look around and say, at least I'm not like that. And there's not too much wrong with sitting on the couch drinking a couple beers. But it wasn't a couple beers. And it probably wasn't even that it was that much. It was that I was obsessed about making it happen, and I was employing some really interesting tactics to make sure that I drank. And if you would have asked me at the time if I was an alcoholic, I would have said no. And if there was any problem with my behavior, I would have said no. And it's pretty understandable why, because I grew up in a family where the definition of alcoholism was kind of like Skid Row drunk or drinking on the street and drinking out of a bag or drinking all day long. And it really wasn't an option for me to drink all day long, but I very quickly started saying stuff to myself like, I don't drink all day long and I don't drink out of a bag. And it would have been really hard for on the street. It would have been really hard for those things to happen in my life because my family situation would not have permitted it. So I just kept doing things that just fed my denial. And by the time I got to college, it was the first time I was out there where I was really unsupervised. Like in my house, when I came home as a youngster, I had to check in with my mom and let her know that I was home. And if I didn't come home, it would be a huge problem. And I had all these little like checks and balances, for lack of a better word. So when I got off to college, I was completely on my own. And the you-know-what hit the fan fast. I think I got there in August, and by October, my drinking had kind of scared me out of my mind. Because once I didn't have to answer to anybody, all kinds of heck broke loose. I went to all these places with all these people I didn't know, and I got in cars with people who were intoxicated and rode off into the country in Southern Maryland, and I didn't know where I was. You know, it wasn't like we were carrying around cell phones or everything was theoretically safer. It was a nightmare. And one night, one morning, I guess it was at this point, I woke up in my bed, like completely covered in vomit and the last thing I remembered was I was going to a Halloween party, which is kind of funny now that it's Halloween, but I was going to a Halloween party, and I kind of thought I was hitting it a little hard the last couple weeks, and so I was going to not drink at this party, and there was a giant punch bowl. And I'm like, oh, great, punch. So I go over there, and it's filled with grain alcohol. Of course, I have no idea, because I just had no idea. And I'm dancing in my costume and sucking down this red punch. So I was having a hot flash real fast because I just ingested a massive amount of grain alcohol and didn't know it. And so apparently what happened was I said, damn, it's hot in here. And I went out the door and started walking down the lane, which down in the most southern part of Maryland, the lane is a country road with, like, ditches on the side, and the houses are really far between each other. And somebody found me there. Some people stopped on the side of the road to see what was in the ditch, and it turned out to be me. And they picked me up and took me home, and they picked me up and took me back to the party and said, does anyone know a drunk blonde? And my roommates said, we do. And then they got me back to the dorm, and I woke up in my bed, and I had no clue how I got there. So I wasn't a blackout drinker. I don't know if I mentioned that. And by I'm not a blackout drinker, it doesn't mean that I necessarily never had a blackout, although I don't think I really did. I had some brownouts where I couldn't remember portions of the night. But this particular night, I walked intoxicated, I don't know how far, maybe a mile, until I fell over because I passed out. So I passed out and rolled into this ditch, and I was lying there throwing my guts up for I don't know how long. But it wasn't until years later that I realized had I rolled and landed on my back that night, I would have aspirated and died instead of landing on my stomach, where instead I just was lying there in my own vomit with my arms pinned under my chest and absolutely unable to move myself. So this really frightened me. So I thought I'd better lay off, and I did. I laid off in a big way. And around that time, I started going out with a guy who was court-slipped to go to meetings. And I was carrying this guy off to meetings. So here we go into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's about as happy to be there as I am because we're both really friendly people. He doesn't think he has a problem with alcohol, but the court slips are making him go. So we're in there having a grand old time. Neither one of us thinks we need to be there. And he does something to violate his situation and goes off to jail. And I'm like, I'll keep going to the meetings for you. So I keep going to the meetings because I like it. And that's like, I've mentioned a few times, I've heard a lot of stories about how you got to AA. I've never heard that one, except the 6 million times I've had to tell it myself, and I don't always tell it. I'm kind of sick of it. But it was sort of uneventful. You know, I just came into AA and thought, well, there's all this cool stuff happening here. Glad it's here for you people. You know, that's that. And I was really drawn to a lot of things about AA. I was drawn to the friendly people. I was drawn to the God concepts. The God concepts were not off-putting to me at all, except kind of in my mind. They were like a little too broad. They weren't religious enough for my taste at the time. And so I thought, you know, I'm not powerless over alcohol, but I did have a problem with alcohol, and it's probably okay for me to hang around here a little bit. Besides that, I need to get boyfriends slip signed, so you can understand how much I understood about that situation. Zip. And so I came to one meeting a week and met some people and had some good times and smoked some cigarettes and washed some coffee cups and shook a lot of hands and said a lot of serenity prayers. And I probably looked like I was comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous and that I might become an AA member, or maybe that I considered myself one. But some things were happening at the time, like I didn't tell anyone anything about my drinking. And I went for I don't know how long listening to people talk about the big book, having no idea what book they were talking about. And there was no way that I was going to go and say, what is the big book? Because then I would have acted like I didn't know something. And this was completely unappealing to me. And, you know, our book right here says Alcoholics Anonymous on the front. It doesn't say big book. I'm pretty bright and everything, but I couldn't figure it out. And there was no way that I was going to ask. And so sometimes I like to run down how I used to look at the steps just to give you an idea what I thought of myself and what I thought of my drinking. And I like to talk about it when they're on the wall because then people who don't know them in their heads have a better clue what I'm talking about. But, you know, I mentioned that I didn't think I was an alcoholic or that I was powerless over alcohol. So I skipped the first step. And the next two steps are God steps. And I had been brought up in a religious family, and I was all proud of myself because I was in a religious organization in high school. Who does that? Nobody. And I was in a, not really, but, and then I was in a religious organization in college. Who does that? Nobody. I ran a women's study group in college. Meanwhile, all that stuff is still going on because, like I said, I wasn't telling people what was really going on with me. So the path was going like this. I was being who I believed I was meant to be. And I was believing, and I was being also who my alcoholism was dictating that I become. And this path got more farther and farther apart. So anyway, so two and three are God steps, and I thought I could probably tell you a thing or two about God. I got the God thing down, so I skipped those. And then the fourth step is about a searching and fearless moral inventory. And I seriously sat right where you are and looked at the steps and thought, there's nothing wrong with me except for the fact that I drink too much. And I found out later that's a pretty common sentiment with people who drink too much, especially if they were raised like I was and didn't have certain kinds of problems manifesting in their lives. So I've skipped the fourth step, and if you're going to skip the fourth, then you have to skip the fifth, because there's nothing to admit to anyone else. And then back to six and seven, we were on to another God step, so that was skippable as well. And then eight and nine were about making a list of people we'd harmed and making amends to them, and I was certain I had not harmed anyone. And that's also a fairly common sentiment. Usually, as I've talked to alcoholics in AA, people are really clear that they have harmed a million people, or not a million, but a lot of people, or they're in the I haven't harmed anybody but myself camp. I haven't met a whole lot of people that are way in between. Or they may say something like, well, maybe my spouse, or well, maybe my child. But so I was in the I haven't harmed anybody but myself camp, so I skipped eight and nine. And then if you're going to skip four, you may as well skip 10 because they're both inventory steps. Mm-hmm. And 11 is another God step. And then I was already spiritually awake, so I thought, I guess I could carry the message. I mean, after all, I've been hanging around here enough. I know what you're talking about. So one funny thing that pops into my mind is, I always like to say, can you imagine how many times they told me to keep coming back? Probably a lot. But, not that keep coming back is a dig, because I think it is sometimes, you know. But a lot of times it's the most heartfelt thing I've ever heard. And I think that when they offered me that expression, even if they thought, she doesn't know what she's talking about, most people didn't think that. Most people could just see that denial is like being asleep, you know. You don't know that you've been in it until you wake up. And it's just kind of like they just said, keep coming back. And they patted me on the shoulder. And I came back for a while, but, you know, sometimes they say if you're an alcoholic, you take the alcohol out, you still have the ick. I had a ton of ick. and absolutely zero awareness of it until once I stopped drinking, the conditions in my life deteriorated enough that sort of pointed at the ick. And, you know, for many of us, we say alcohol wasn't the problem, alcohol was a solution. If you are that kind of alcoholic, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. Of course it was the problem, but it was also the solution. I mean, it's just like some of us to get the cart before the horse and be like, no, this is the glue that's holding me together. Yes, until everything falls apart because the solution's not about glue. I mean, I definitely made various kinds of messes in my life that were really being ick-like. And everything that I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous sort of fell on deaf ears. Because really, if you're not down with the first step, 2 through 12, really, what's the point? I mean, what's the point in picking up tools and finding a solution for a problem you don't have? And I got myself in a lot of really painful situations and hurt some people deeply. And I usually don't launch into it because it's stuff that it's like in my fourth step. But I started making references to all the dishonesty that I was becoming really good at. Just the level of dishonesty that I had going on in my life and how I kind of operated out of this what you don't know won't hurt you mentality. I don't have to be actually drinking to do any of that at all. So that crap started to catch up with me, and I usually don't cuss when I'm at the microphone or try not to, but a lot of times I've lost the ability to see crap and hell as cuss words. So those kind of slip out sometimes. And I just, you know, there came, you know, there talks about in the big book where it says there's no mental defense against the first drink. There comes to a time when there's no mental defense. I was all about my spirituality and my religion, but I was not at all about talking to my higher power about my alcoholism. It was like my drinking behavior was over here and my God self was over here. And I think many of us have had experience in our lives where we're turning things over to our higher power, if we have one, and or even the power of the group, you know. It doesn't have to be a God thing. We're turning things over to this process and then we're going, accept this. And, you know, that sci-fi movie about that guy holding onto the ring. I don't know if you know what I'm referencing. I can't even think of the name of it. But like the you can't have this. I was holding on to some things like that and not even recognizing that I was holding them on like that. And if I would have been that creature holding onto the ring and stumbled in front of a mirror, I would have scared myself because I would not have known that that was me. I didn't perceive myself that way. So I drank again, no big surprise. And what the short version of what led up to that was I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and it was all a matter of time before I started justifying why it was okay to do certain things. Like, there aren't really any rules in AA, so AA doesn't say, hey, you can't have beer in your house. So I was like, AA doesn't say you can't have beer in your house. So I put beer in my house, you know. And the way that I was raised, it's nice to have alcohol in the house for company. I mean, why not? So I put the beer in my house, and it wasn't really my house. It was my dorm room, and it was about that big. But I put it in there, and then I was like, great. And never once crossed my mind, like, I bought my favorite alcohol to put in the fridge or whatever for my friends. And so I was thinking to myself, you know, it's been a while since I've gotten myself into trouble with alcohol, and it's probably okay if I'm sitting in my own dorm room and I have friends over. And, you know, my roommate knew that I wasn't drinking, and she came over and came home one night, and I was drinking with some people in the house, and she was like, hey, you're not, I thought you weren't, what are you doing? And I said, I got people over, and we're just having a few beers. What's the big deal? And then in short order, she'd come home, and the people were over, and we were all wasted. And I'd say, she'd say, hey, you're wasted. And I'd say, yeah, but it's not a problem if I'm wasted. It's a problem if I'm wasted when there's not a party going on. You know, it's a problem if I'm wasted and I'm by myself. And she would come home one day, and as things progressed, I'd be sitting in the room by myself drinking. And she'd say, you're drinking by yourself. And I'd say, oh, but I'm not drunk. It's only a problem if I'm drunk, you know. And then, of course, she came home and I was drunk by myself. And this is how it goes. Like, whatever line I draw in the sand about my alcoholism, it might not be the line that you draw, but the lines that I was drawn, I was crossing. So I was off to the races then. Things got bad probably within a couple of months. Like, I've seen in AA where people drink and then bam, you know, they just get one drink, bam, something terrible happens within 24 hours, you know. And then other people, they just go out there and slide along for I don't know how long until something bad happens. And so that's what was happening to me. I was just kind of sliding along. And I was out there for about a year and a half, and 6 months into it, I really got the feeling by the conditions in my life that my relationship with alcohol was not working. And I started to feel powerless, mostly because I had all this junk going on in my life that wasn't going on before. And really the only thing that had changed was the booze. And this was, I mean, it was all kinds of stuff. It was abusive relationships. It was riding around with drunk people behind the wheel, and I'm in the passenger seat going, I'm smart. I'm not driving. I'm not getting no DWI. But I'm riding in the car with somebody who's 10 times as wasted as I am. And I'm talking about how smart I am. I mean, just these situations. And the degree that I was kidding myself is kind of astonishing. So about 6 months into it, I felt like I needed to get sober. And I'd wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to drink today. And by 5 o'clock, I'd be on the bar stool. And the first couple of times that happened, I blew it off. I just forgot. I forgot that I meant to get sober. And then, you know, after a while, every single day I was getting up and I was on the bar stool by 5 or 12 or 2. Or I wasn't on the bar stool, but it was okay because we were over at a friend's picnic table having blue crabs. And who doesn't drink beer when they have blue crabs? I mean, you can imagine, I just started all this stuff because it was so much easier for me to tell myself all that bull than it was to say, hey, you drew a line in the sand and you crossed it. Hey, you drew a line in the sand and you crossed it. And even if I was able to say that to myself, my very next phrase to myself was, yeah, but, and then whatever else happened. So I didn't get sober until I stopped saying, yeah, but. And that didn't happen to me until I was in a bar fight. Going to be a bar fight, but it turned out to be out in the street in front of the bar where we started to fight, and then we took it outside. And this girl that I was fighting with had made me really mad and had been really abusive, and I was really unhappy with the way that she spoke to me and treated me and all this crap she was saying. So I was like, let's take it outside. So once we got out there, she beat me pretty hard. And I was like, well, what I mean is, you know, and I got her by the scruff of the shirt and jacked her up against the wall. And I said, you cannot do that to me. And I was like, I don't think you quite get how pissed off I am and how exactly big I'm going to get in about 2 seconds. And when I let her down, she did it again. And I went flying across the parking lot. And like, you know, when you tell a story, you can stretch it if you want. I was thinking, while I was sailing across the parking lot, I was remembering that this whole issue that I was having at the moment was a total metaphor for my relationship with booze. that it was all fine and dandy for a moment or two or 10 or 20. It doesn't matter how many moments it was fine and dandy. And then it went south. And when it went south, I had no control over it, and I puffed up, and I, like, jacked it up against the wall and said, "You're not going to do that to me." Like my friend Bob, or Don, what happened? Sorry. That's my alarm to remind me to make a phone call every Sunday night. I forgot to turn it off. Hopefully it went off. Jacked up against the wall and said, "You're not going to do that to me." And my friend Bob or Don, I can't remember, he's been gone for so long now, he said, "Recovery begins when the great I am becomes nothing." And I had, I was up there like, "You cannot do that to me because I'm whatever." And then the second I, let go, bash. And I thought I was smart enough. I thought I came from too nice a family. I thought I was too young, whatever we do. Anyway, so I went flying across the parking lot and landed in the pavement. And while I was laying there, all these people were all around because there was a girl fight out front. And I just looked up, and all I could see were the stars and the black sky. And I was just lying there, just like flat on my back. And I just thought, God, all those old dudes in AA were right. And it was like the truest thing that I had said to myself in I don't know how long. I was like, oh, my God, they were right. And the beauty of that is they were right, which means there's a solution. Like, I had been around a ton of solution for a problem I didn't think I had. And I had just taken a severe beating, but I just was like, I could have done the happy dance if I wasn't lying flat on my back because I just gotten busted in the face. And I felt so much peace. I felt so much peace that I had given up, that I had just let go. And it was like, imagine the beatings I'm not going to take if I don't get in the ring with the beater. I was like, woohoo. So I've also heard a lot of stories and haven't heard too many people talk about their bottom, their bottom or whatever when they're saying, woohoo. But I was so relieved. And I have had that exact sense of relief this whole entire, whatever it is, 10,400 and whatever days or 10,500 days. I've had that same relief ever since, because when I came back this time, I put steps into my life and I started following suggestions. So that meant when I was cleaning coffee cups, I wasn't cleaning coffee cups in the meeting because my mama raised me right. I was cleaning coffee cups because I was a grateful alcoholic. See, I'm choked now. I was a grateful alcoholic, and I was changing my ways because I was taught in AA, not that I listened, that gratitude was an action word. And instead of saying, "Why do I have to clean the ashtrays?" I cleaned the ashtrays because there used to be ashtrays. Maybe there are some places, but we had ashtrays we had to clean, and I thought that was disgusting, and why do I have to clean the ashtrays? Uh-uh. All of that just went flying out the window, and I folded chairs and set up meetings, and occasionally something would happen that I was completely clueless about where somebody would say, "Come on, we're going over to stand in the parking lot of this funeral home because this AA dude has a dead relative." And I'd be like, "Say what? It's Friday night, man." Where I would say, "We're doing what?" And he'd say, "No, get in the car because we're going to go over and hang out in the parking lot for this guy in AA who's going through a really hard time." And out there we'd be standing in the parking lot because the AA members there were thoughtful enough that they didn't want to clog up the 8x10 funeral home. So we were all out there supporting the AA member. And I didn't even know who he was. And to me, that's the kind of stuff that brings me to tears in the middle of my sentence, 80% of the time, because I get that now. I never would have understood what that was about before. And so I cranked up my meeting attendance. I got a sponsor. I was fixing to graduate from college by the skin of my teeth because, you know, my grades were since I had been relapsing. And I was, like, on academic probation, and it was, I got sober in March, and I was graduating in June or May. And so I went to a lot more meetings down there in the college town, and I stopped hanging out in the dorm rooms with all the people who were partying, and I started riding around with all these guys. I call them the weird dudes in AA because that's who I thought they were. I mean, I was, you know, young. And I started doing things differently. And I went to Dunkin' Donuts, even though I thought it was like it made me want to kill myself that I was in Dunkin' Donuts in college on a Saturday night with a bunch of old men and maybe one random old lady. And what happened was everything that is the AA way started to seep all the way into my bones. And I sat in this woman's kitchen who sponsored me, sat across from her and smoked cigarettes and drank coffee and took my inventory and set it back and forth and did service work in my home group, and I just took off from there. And when I was able, I don't even remember when it was, I sponsored people. When do I stop? 5 till? What? When I, or now? Okay. So when I was able to, I started sponsoring people. And the way that I got through my steps was I wrote a lot of it out, but I was sponsored by a woman who said, "You're a drunk if you say you're a drunk, and if you know you're not in charge, that's it. Start writing." You know, like for 1, 2, and 3. Kind of it says in the book very quickly, you know, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. So I was like writing out my 4-step right away. And, you know, I think realistically I had the insight of a doornail. Mm-hmm. I don't think that I had clue one what I needed to work on. But what I did see, I put down. And I was honest about everything that I had awareness over. And then, of course, as the years have gone by, I have more insight. I have more awareness. I know myself better. But that's what my 10th step's for. Like, as time's gone on, I've, writing about my 10th step, that's a later conversation, but I dumped all that out. And I already knew that I had a relationship with a higher power and just that I'd been holding things back. And so every time that I had something I wanted to hold back from God, I talked to someone else about. And then, like my sponsor said, "Did you talk to God about it?" And I'd say, "Well, doesn't he know my heart? Doesn't he? Isn't he here in this conversation?" And she'd be like, "Get in there and get on your knees and fess up." So, I mean, that's just the kind of AA that I came into. But that's not the only AA there is. It's not the only way to do it. It's not like it's the best. It's just, you know, we do it differently all over the states and towns and everything else. So I just had one of those. So I read the big book and got very involved, and I've been very, very involved ever since. And so I had the same sponsor for, God, probably like 20 years, something like that. And the reason was I'm crazy about her. I left her in Maryland when I moved away from Maryland about 6 years ago. And I'd been with her for so long, I didn't want to find another one. So what happens is she gets called whenever there's something going on in my life that when someone says, "Did you call your sponsor?" I want to be able to say yes. So she gets called when those situations come up. But what happens is I have a lot of friends in AA, and I also have a 10th step buddy. So my 10th step buddy is someone who's been sober for a while, although I don't think that matters at all. So, you know, someone who has a working knowledge of the program. And when I take my inventory, which is however many times a day I get in my way, which is often, I like whip out a piece of toilet paper and scribble some stuff down or a paper towel wad or whatever, and I write, what am I ticked about and what am I afraid of, and you know, just what's going on with me. And another helpful suggestion that I got from hanging out in the rooms, which isn't in the literature, is just for shifting my perspective, what would my behavior or the situation look like if God were involved? Like, if I actually, like, came at it like I wasn't doing it by myself. And that helps me, drop deep, more deeply into my faith practice. So I don't like having any secrets. And there was a bunch of stuff that I didn't want to tell people, just like everyone else. And, you know, when my sponsor heard my fourth step, she fell asleep in the middle of it. And I thought I was so riveting. When I tell you this thing, I'm going to faint because it's so big. And, you know, she doesn't care. And now I've heard a million fifth steps, and I don't care. And in fact, a lot of the things people tell me, it's like they drop into the AA vault and they're gone. Poof. And my sponsees, they say, remember the thing I was telling you about, blah, blah, blah? No. Can you tell me a little bit more? And then after they tell me more, I go, okay, oh yeah, that. And we go from there. But it just drops into this sacred place, and that's it. So I go to a lot of meetings, and I have tools for dealing with my malcontent self when they come up. I might pout for a second or two, like I don't want to use my tools, and I don't want to tell anybody. But my tolerance for that has dropped dramatically over the years. And, you know, before I would not have noticed myself in that state. Now I cannot stand myself in that state for more than a brief period of time. The other thing is I know that if I leave those things unchecked, I'm moving toward a drink. So it's not that if I'm fearful and angry and trying to be dishonest or not wanting to tell someone what's really going on. It's not that if I have those things, I'm moving to a drink. It's that if I don't see those things and address those things and get the tools to work on them, that I'm moving in that direction. So I'm not attached to being perfect, but I am attached to using the tools and raking myself over this program that we already know, that I already know has worked for millions of drunks that have come before me that I am no longer different from. And that is one of the huge reasons why I like to take a minute and drop into, imagine how many people are saying this serenity prayer right now, because I'm not the kind of special I was. I'm another kind of special, because there's not another drunk like me in the rooms, except everybody. My friend always says, yeah, special like we all are. And that's true. And I believe that today, and I can stand myself today. And I can stand being an alcoholic, and I can stand being a sober member of AA, and thank you guys for listening.